CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.
On a hiatus, and where better to start than with the two issues, sorry about this, bedeviling the UK's post-pandemic recovery, inflation and the state of the recovery, and the skills crisis. First, we'll hear from John Stebbeck, executive editor of Moneyweek, and then from Mark Creighton of Avado. To John, then. As well as serving as executive editor at Moneyweek, John, like I, is up with the larks to write a morning business email. What he doesn't know about investing in the UK probably isn't worth knowing. He started out in journalism writing articles about family firms before joining the finance desk of Teletext. Yes, that Teletext, before joining Moneyweek some 16 years ago. John, pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Andy.
Absolute pleasure. We're talking on the day that we got second quarter GDP figures out, all very jolly, as you'd perhaps expect, because we were all very excited going to the pub, being allowed to go to the pub and restaurants and theatres and other such things. But just in terms of the state of the recovery more broadly, as a man who knows a thing or two about the state of the British economy, what's your kind of reading on it on a scale of 1 to 10, if you were, if wild optimism was 10 and 1 out of 10 was going back to the cave and buying some firewood and a cow that you could skin and eat eventually. Where are you?
I'm around about a 7, whereas okay. I used to be at about a 9. So that's obviously a slight kind of come down. And if I'm honest, the main reason for that is because obviously we've had a massive bounce back from COVID. And to my mind, that was always going to happen because you shut the economy down and then when you start it back up, of course, it's going to rev into a very fast gear. The problem, obviously, now that we're having, though, is with all these shortages and the supply chain problems. Mm. And the thing is, the energy one in particular is a worry because if there's one thing that's going to hammer the consumer's appetite to go out to the pub, it's the fact that A, you can't get petrol, B, if you can get it, it costs you an arm and a leg. And when you're sitting at home with the heating on, you know, you're burning kind of like £5 notes with every kind of like, you know, kilowatt hour that you're using up. So that, I think, is probably the biggest headwind, never mind, you know, central bank faffing about with, you know, are we going to raise rates? Are we not going to raise rates?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's the thing. It sounds stupid, and you have, I think, an educated audience of listeners, but there is nothing that energy costs don't touch, right? Be it consumer appetite, be it the price of things getting to supermarket shelves. And I suppose, as we look, everyone's talking about Christmas at the moment and shortages around Christmas, but these shortages that we've got in terms of labour in particular, all of this has been foreseen for some time. The government response to this point has been, I'm sure the people you talk to say similar as the people that are talking to me, that government response so far has been pretty lacklustre in terms of immigration visas and various other things. Is that the sort of thing that knocks confidence in investors when you have a problem that people knew about, a problem that was going to have pretty severe consequences, and yet action doesn't seem to have been taken?
If I'm honest, I see that more as that's just politics, and that's what politicians tend to do. I mean, you're right that this particular problem has been floating about for years and years. To be fair, though, it is a global issue. I know that it's very easy to kind of blame this on Brexit and also to get a bit parochial whenever we look at the state of our own government. And, you know, I mean, yeah, there's plenty of things you can criticise them for. But for example, I'd point out that I was reading a report this morning that Poland has got a shortage of 100,000 HGV drivers. You know, so this isn't a new thing. New Zealand's running out of HGV drivers as well. So on the one hand, you're absolutely right to say that this has been foreseen for a long time. I mean, going back years, we've seen that there's, you know, a kind of shortage here. But A, it's global. And B, the other thing that I think is interesting, no one actually foresaw the level of supply problems that we're having now as a result of coming out of the pandemic. You know, when you look at the inflation figures and you look at what was being forecast, we've already redefined transitory about six times this year. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, no, it's going to go away. Oh, what, it hasn't? Oh, okay, well, you know, let's stretch the definition of transitory to mean a few more months, maybe the end of 2022. So I don't think Britain particularly stands out as being, you know, especially incompetent on that front.
Mm. And on inflation, I mean, everybody has a gut instinct on these things rather than any crystal ball. But I agree with you. The definition of transitory is stretching to the point of the inelastic at this point. And it certainly won't feel transitory, I guess, was your point at the start, right, about energy prices. It certainly won't feel transitory to people who are looking at their cost of living, their energy bills, the cost of filling up the tank with oil going through the roof now as well. You know, does that lead us, there's a piece on your website about whether it's back to the 70s. I mean, I think, touch wood, we won't have rubbish bags piling up in Leicester Square. But, you know, you've got a good feel for the investor community. Is it starting to, not even starting, is it a genuine worry that we are going into almost the worst possible recovery? Or is there still optimism that actually we've gone through a once-in-a-lifetime, hopefully, event? And that this is just the sort of shakeout at the end of it and things will return to, hopefully, normal in a couple of years' time?
I suppose that's the big debate. Is the problem with inflation and transitory inflation is that the longer that it hangs about, the more opportunity it has to sink into the labour market and get into wages and also end good sort of price rises. And we're already starting to see that. I was actually reading a piece from Capital Economics this morning, where the Australian New Zealand economist is talking about how they now think that inflation is going to be more persistent in Australia because the unions are now talking about wanting higher wages to compensate for higher costs. And that kind of thing could easily happen because obviously, you know, if we keep talking about how we've got labour shortages and we have, then the obvious solution to that is higher wages. And I actually think higher wages are a good thing. From a big picture point of view, we spent too long with the pendulum swinging from labour to capital, and now it's starting to swing back the way, which partly explains the political upheaval we've had as well. And I think that that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's going to make the investment backdrop very different. You know, we've, since going back to 1980, really, we've been in an environment of falling interest rates and constant disinflation, basically. And now even COVID, to an extent, has just accelerated a shift to where we're going back into a more inflationary environment. And even in the last few months, I would say that more and more people have started to agree with that point of view, basically. It might not be back to the 1970s, but the sort of cycle of endless disinflation or even deflation has probably been broken. And that could have quite profound consequences for portfolios. And this is why people keep talking about how the 60-40 portfolio is dead. It may or may not be true, but you know, if we do go into a more inflationary environment, then you know that might happen. You know, we might need to kind of consider looking at serious changes to the way that we do asset allocation.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, the 60-40 portfolio has been discussed a lot recently in sort of personal finance side of things. But I guess taking a big picture, if you take away, you know, fears and worries about the UK economy or the global economy, one of the things that we keep hearing a lot, I was talking to a shareholder of Entain the other day. It's obviously the subject of a pretty sizable bid from DraftKings. And they were saying that, you know, it's not a surprise because UK stocks remain wildly undervalued, massive takeover targets. So on the one hand, in the UK, you've got this sort of economic concern about the recovery and shortages, supply chains and various other things. On the other hand, you've got a stock market that's still broadly undervalued, according to global investors. Does that mean, you know, in terms of thinking about portfolios and investors, are they, do they, are they more worried, more interested, I should say, in the economic recovery in the UK, or are they more interested in piling into undervalued firms that could become takeover targets in the not too distant future?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, the most important factor in your future returns is how cheap an asset is when you buy it, basically. So, and UK stocks are undeniably cheap compared to all other developed world markets, and some emerging markets. And, you know, and that's partly a hangover from the political turmoil for the last 5 years. You know, politics is complicated. Brexit was particularly complicated. And if you were a global fund manager and a UK weighting is only about 5 or 6% of your whole portfolio, then you could easily just park it in the too difficult bin, you know, and stick that 5% in the US instead, and it went up and you were fine. You know, and none of your clients are going to come running to you saying, why are you investing in Britain? It's, you know, it's a basket case. It's had the audacity to leave the EU, et cetera, et cetera. And now I think we're just seeing that slightly reverse. And also, you know, I think it's partly because the pound was so weak for so long as well, and it's still relatively weak. But I think that sort of private equity rush to dash in and buy companies just now is partly trying to get in before the bargains all disappear, and the prices kind of recover. And it's interesting, actually, because you see a lot of fund managers complaining when a private equity group jumps in on, you know, something like, you know, one of the supermarkets or Meggitt or whatever. And they're saying, oh, you know, they're getting this really cheap. And you're kind of like, well, yeah, but, you know, why weren't you guys buying more?
Yeah, you could have bought it.
Exactly. If you think it's so cheap, then, you know, buy more of it. So, you know, I mean, I think it's a good thing. And, you know, nobody thinks these guys are stupid. So to my mind, it makes sense for kind of private investors to, you know, think about tilting their portfolio a bit more towards the UK, or at least, you know, I mean, obviously lots of UK-based private investors already arguably have too much exposure to the UK. But, you know, if you're kind of in a kind of globally balanced portfolio, a tilt towards the UK, I think would make sense.
I guess my last question is around crypto, which is, of course, not tied to anything, really, be it, you know, location or substance or commodity, etc., etc. I'm not going to get you into the where's and wherefores of whether crypto is a good thing or a bad thing or whether you should pile in or not. But just in terms of kind of sort of speaking hack to hack, I guess, you know, in terms of the interest that you've got from people, you know, engaging with Money Week, have you noticed, as we have, this just massive uptick in people looking around at this? And if so, I guess, what do you think the implications are thereof?
I mean, definitely, certainly earlier this year, particularly when Bitcoin, you know, and Dogecoin were kind of heading to the moon, as it were, there was a massive uptick in traffic, for example, to articles about Bitcoin. It's eased off in that, basically, I tend to find that the interest goes up alongside the price, and whenever it's looking a bit wobbly, it comes back down again. I think that, and as much, I mean, I have a very basic understanding of crypto, and I think that there's something to it. I understand roughly what the point of Bitcoin is, and I think that, you know, it's assuming that the code is what people say it is, then it's probably an asset that's here to stay in some way. I think the fact that people are so interested in it doesn't necessarily tell us that much. It could be, you know, it's like when during the tech bubble, you know, suddenly lots of kind of small investors get very excited about tech stocks. But when that burst, the sheer volume of interest dropped off and never really recovered. And that doesn't mean that, you know, obviously we still get Amazon 20 years later, one of the biggest companies in the world. But I think that the kind of froth, if you like, will get blown off, and then maybe 20 years, 10 years from now, you know, we'll actually have found a kind of proper use for blockchain and Bitcoin.
Yeah, there's a place not too far from my office here which sells fine wine, and in order to get rid of fakes and frauds. They use blockchain to sort of monitor the progress of this bottle of wine from, you know, a vineyard 35 years ago to your table. And that strikes me as being a very worthwhile use of blockchain, in my opinion. Anyway, I shall let's park it there, and we'll no doubt revisit this another time. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Andy.
Pleasure. And now we turn to another of Britain's challenges, or perhaps opportunities, who's to say? The skills crisis has been talked about ad nauseum by politicians for many, many years, be it in technical skills, human skills, soft power skills, whatever you want to call it. And of course, now the skill of simply being able to drive a lorry from one petrol station to a refinery. But there are some companies on the market hoping to change what we think of as corporate learning and development, which for many will no doubt bring you out slightly in hives, as you remember, away days in M1 conference hotels. Anyway, Mark Creighton is the leader of Avado, a digital learning and physical learning provider which is doing some really interesting things as we start to think about reskilling the workforce for the modern day. Mark's here now. Mark, great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Why don't we kick off with, and I always find it far more interesting to hear from the horse's mouth rather than about us sections on websites, no matter how well crafted they are. Why don't you give us the sort of the Avado story, I guess?
Yeah, so Avado's a learning and development business. We're very focused on kind of the professional and future skills that organizations and individuals are going to need as we move forward. And we deliver that to about sort of 25,000 learners, both here in the UK and across the world, through apprenticeships, professional qualifications, and also sort of corporate training programs that really focus on some of the new behaviors and new mindsets that those organizations are going to need, both, I guess, in taking advantage of this new economy that I think we're going to see after the pandemic, but also thinking about how their organization better works together to solve some of the new problems that maybe their customers have, but also their organizations have as well.
And just talk to me about what that sort of learning experience looks like for me coming into it, if I was joining one of your programs.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very customized. I think one of the things we've realized over sort of working in this for 10 years is that in order that learning experiences are engaging, but also that you can apply what you learn into what you do in your job, it has to be a real world thing. So we think about how we take, say, business problems of our customers and we put them at the heart of the learning. So it's less conceptual, it's very practical. And we think about, okay, how do we use almost the learning experience to solve the business problem, or at least give you the tools and the ability to do that? I think the second thing is that, you know, learning experiences, we still believe, are about a combination of different interventions. So you can learn some stuff on your own. You still need experts to teach you some of the aspects of those technical skills that might be important. And also you need to do group work. So you need to almost learn from other people, hear how they've interpreted the learning, and maybe work together on a specific element of that learning. So it's kind of a combination of different teaching and learning techniques that we think leads to the best learning outcomes. And actually, you can deliver that both virtually, and obviously we've had a huge amount of that during the pandemic, but also you can still do it face-to-face. So we think a blend of some of those experiences is actually, again, really important to getting people to take whatever they learn and be able to apply it in what they do.
Yeah, and you alluded there to the pandemic. I think we need sort of a different name for it almost, sort of the bad times, I don't know. But, you know, there are a lot of people that did perhaps more useful things than I did during lockdown, putting on a few pounds and sort of, frankly, trying very, very lazily to learn Spanish and just about getting to the restaurant section of Rosetta Stone. But did the pandemic change the way companies viewed learning experiences? Because when you have such a disruption as we had, obviously there was a sort of 2-3-4 week period where everything was up in the air and it was all about keeping businesses going, working out which of the government schemes was the one to go for, etc. But as we kind of got past that period and we started to realize this was a longer term thing, that it was going to be something that would shape our lives, I guess, and certainly our business lives. Was there a rethinking around the learning space, around skills and upskilling in that period, both at a sort of business level and at the employee level, thinking about the skills they need for the future?
So a couple of things we definitely saw, which I think are positives. The first one was that a lot of organizations, probably more than individuals, reappraised what they thought virtual learning was. I think a lot of people had got stuck in a mindset that said, learning virtually is that terrible mandatory compliance training that you have that is like running through treacle, and it's just kind of something I have to do, and therefore it's not very engaging. And what we were able to do with some of those companies was say, well, that's a really bad experience of virtual learning. Here's what you can do, and it can be both human interventions, lots of different kind of types of learning that can be incorporated. So actually, it can be exciting, but also it can also be delivered in very kind of short bursts. So it doesn't have to be kind of something that feels like, oh God, this has taken me a huge amount of time to do. So I think we're able to get that reappraisal of virtual learning and set it in its true light today and where it can be in the future. I think for organizations, the progressive organizations definitely saw the time that was created for people as they were working from home and potentially couldn't maybe do some of the things that they had done within, say, their physical office environments, was to say, here is an opportunity to address some of the skills and behavioral gaps that we know we have as an organization. We wanted to do it, but maybe there was another priority that got ahead of it. Let's take this opportunity. Let's take this space as such. And let's try and put kind of some of those capabilities and skills programs into it. And we did a bit of research earlier this year called Beyond Skills, where we specifically asked about 1,000 leaders in the UK, but also in Asia Pacific as well. And what were their learnings around kind of capability and skills development during the pandemic? And a big one that came out was that 71% of businesses that saw growth across that period, that dark period of the pandemic, also increased their training budgets during that period as well. So they invested in training to the benefit of business growth. So they saw that there were things that they didn't have or needed, or actually they saw things they could take advantage of. And obviously we've seen, we talk a lot about kind of the business negatives of the pandemic, but actually a lot of business have thrived. It's allowed them to really accelerate maybe some of those sort of digital to consumer channels. And a lot of this training, I think, has been invested to make sure that they didn't miss out on that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking ad nauseum at the moment in the newsroom. You can probably hear it in the background. There's absolutely no shortage of construction workers in the city at the moment. They all seem to use the bit outside my office as a sort of driving track. Anyway, I'll park that for now. But there, you know, we are talking a lot about labour shortages in the economy at the moment, and that's completely right that we talk about those things, be it lorries or care home staff and all those other things. But your research showed that in the sort of traditional workplace, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, there is a skills gap. You called it a capability chasm. You know, is there enough of a focus still? Because goodness knows government ministers talk about it enough and have talked about it for years, about Britain needing to upskill and everybody needing to reskill and get ready for the technological revolution and all that jazz. Do we still take it seriously as a country, do you think?
I don't think we're as focused on it as we need to be. And I think, you know, when you look at the impacts, you know, the predicted impacts of things like Brexit, As a country, we need to figure out where do we want to focus our skills agenda such that we can benefit ourselves in the global economy. So I don't know. I don't think there's been enough focus in terms of how are we going to be a winner in the world in kind of some of the future skills that will define it. And while I think there's interesting messages coming through, obviously around kind of carbon neutrality, and some of the intent that we have around some of the skills funding to drive that as a new kind of skill and an industry for the country, I think we're going to have to go a lot faster than we're going. I think our research brought out a couple of things around kind of, you know, people have talked about skills gaps for years, you know, the technical skills that we don't have, whether they're in data or technology or IT. But I think the reason why we're positioning it as this capability chasm is it's not just about having specialists that can do those things. It's other parts of an organization that have to have an appreciation and understanding of how to use technology in order that the whole organization can be more agile, can work faster, can capitalize maybe on the infrastructure that they've built. So if you look at data skills, there's no good in having like data scientists and data analysts if you haven't got people in HR, marketing, customer services, that understand how to work with them, but also understand the information insight that they're providing. So organizations that say, we're just going to fill a skills gap over here, well, it's an island. You ultimately have to figure out how you're going to connect that fantastic technical skill to the behaviors of the organization, which means every single employee needs to understand the benefit in their role and how they're going to work with those people. And I think that's where we think that the pandemic has exacerbated that in certain industry sectors. But as I mentioned before, in some sectors, they've actually taken the opportunity to play catch up.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting to talk about the opportunities of the pandemic, because as you're right, we have been focused so much on the negatives, and goodness knows there's been enough negatives in the business world and beyond. But I should say, maybe this is a sort of disruptive moment. I just want to get into that bit about, you know, organisations waking up to things they didn't necessarily have. I know full well from talking to lots of business owners that are harried and busy and just, you know, 101 things getting on and on their to-do list, which is 20 bullet points long. The one at the bottom, which keeps getting carried over from day to day, is investigate a bit of skills training for the workforce, right? You know, when you think about, I mean, what you guys do, Varda, is it... Do you see yourselves as kind of trying to respond to that and accepting the fact that some of the skills training that was on the marketplace before, you mentioned the compliance training that we've all been through. I had some at News UK, which was interminable, until somebody in the newsroom worked out that you could listen to it at twice the speed, which was brilliant. Whistled through it. You know, do you see are you a response to that, kind of using new technology to make this a bit more immersive, a bit more engaging, a bit more, I guess, for want of a better phrase, worthwhile, and that the opportunity cost of all those things you could quote unquote be doing otherwise is actually, yeah, you're above that and giving, yeah, it better value?
You see, if we go back to your list, which is, you know, skills might be at the bottom of a very long list of priorities, I think the way that we try to tackle is to say, well, what's at the top of the priority list, right? So if the top of the priority list is, I don't know, we're not diversifying our product fast enough. Okay, is that the way that you work? i.e. the way that you work is the barrier to you developing product quicker? And is that where the skills need is? So if I could take that problem, which is we're not diversifying our product, and I can put that at heart of a learning experience, that means you're going to answer one of your priorities as well as skill your people. And I think the problem we have at the moment sometimes is we disconnect learning new skills from what are we prioritizing as a business that's going to help us to grow or be more efficient. If you connect the two things together, it's suddenly in the top 3 to 5 things you need to do. But it takes kind of identifying that first bit and saying, well, you should only be spending your L&D budget on answering those priorities. Mm. What you shouldn't be doing is just skilling for the sake of skilling. And I think sometimes organizations give, there's an L&D budget and it's a task. Let's spend some money on skills. There we go, we spent it. Should we spend the same amount next year? Should we spend less? Should we spend more? But if you said to the CEO, what are the top 3 things that you want this business to do? There inevitably is some form of development challenge there that you can put that problem at the heart of. And I think we try to do that. And that, I think, is what, when you get one, long-term engagement, two, you find that you get to scale the opportunity. And that's where the sort of virtual learning bit comes in. It's the opportunity to take it to thousands, if not tens of thousands of employees in a rapid timescale. But it still starts with, can I solve a problem you've got through learning and development that's going to help your business? And I think if people began to join those dots up a bit more, I do think that skills would be a bit more of a priority.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Look, Mark, we will leave it there. That was fascinating, especially in the context that we're all in around skill shortages and with automation and AI and new versions of technology coming down the line. I think we're all going to have to think about reskilling. And I say that as somebody who works in the print media. So I will leave it there. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Andy.
Pleasure. That was Mark Creighton from Avado. That's all from me this week. CityM is now back in print as well as online and in your ears. So I do hope you're able to get all the business news, analysis, trend pieces and features that you could ever want, either in CityM in print, cityam.com, or wherever you find us. Until next week, I'm Andy Sylvester. Thanks so much.
CMC Markets is a pioneering CFD and spread betting provider. With more than 30 years of experience, CMC Markets provides traders with the tools they need to trade confidently. 76% of retail investor accounts lose money.